Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, June 17, 2014, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call. Today, our telephone is about the proposed amendment to the First Amendment. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also this call is being recorded for possible use as a podcast in the future. We welcome back to today's call two return guests, two experts. First, we'll hear opening remarks from both of them of about 6 to 8 minutes, then some back and forth, and then questions from the audience. We're going to hear first from Professor Bradley A. Smith. He's the 2013-14 Judge J. T. Copenhaver Visiting Endowed Chair of Law at the West Virginia University College of Law and the Hosiah H. Blackmore II Shirley M. Nault Designated Professor of Law at the Capital University Law School in Ohio. He's going to give us his opening thoughts, and then we'll hear some responses and opening remarks from Professor Eugene Volokh. He's the Gary T. Schwartz Professor of Law at the UCLA Law School of Law, and perhaps more importantly for our purposes today, they're both long-term members and supporters of the Federalist Society, so we're happy to have both of them here. And with that, Professor Smith, the floor is yours.
All right. Well, thank you, Dean. It's a pleasure to be here today, as always. Today, Eugene and I are going to talk about and then take some questions on, as was mentioned, the constitutional amendment that has been proposed to deal with campaign finance issues. Now, there are actually several amendments that are floating around in Congress, but the one which appears now to be the vehicle of choice is a Senate Joint Resolution 19, sponsored by Senator Tom Udall. And the purpose of this amendment is to is described as amending the First Amendment. Of course, those who follow the Constitution know that we don't typically go back to the document and amend specific portions. So this would simply be a new amendment, but it would have the effect of dramatically altering protections that people have become accustomed to under the First Amendment. The impetus for this is supposedly recent Supreme Court decisions that have liberalized the campaign finance regime, in particular Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission and McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission. Most people here, I think, would be at least generally familiar with those cases. Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission allowed corporations to spend money in connection with elections. McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission removed an aggregate cap on how much an individual could give to all candidates and political committees, political parties combined. Individuals are still limited in how much they can give to any particular candidate. Corporations and unions are still prohibited from giving it all to candidates. But those are the two primary decisions that have liberalized the law. There have been some other Supreme Court and lower court decisions that have also removed some campaign finance restrictions in recent years. What's interesting to me about the amendment is that it does not really address Citizens United and McCutcheon, at least not in any narrow way, but rather it really launches a full-scale assault on the Supreme Court's jurisprudence in Buckley v. Valeo, the landmark campaign finance case of 1976. Very briefly, the amendment consists of four simple sections with a little preamble that begins on each of the first two sections. The first section authorizes Congress to pass legislation. The second section authorizes the states to pass legislation, and they use essentially the same language. And that is, they begin with a preamble that says, to advance the fundamental principle of political equality for all and to protect the integrity of the legislative and electoral processes, Congress, or Section 2, the states, shall have the power to regulate the raising and spending of money and in-kind equivalents with respect to federal elections, including through setting limits on the amount of contributions to candidates for nomination for election to or for election to federal office, and the amount of funds that may be spent by, in support of, or in opposition to such candidates. Section 3 briefly states that nothing in this article shall be construed to grant Congress the power to abridge the freedom of the press, and Section 4 authorizes Congress and the states to implement the article by appropriate legislation. Now, why do I say this is really not an attack on Citizens United, but an attack on Buckley v. Valeo? It's pretty simple. First is the argument, the preamble itself, which says to advance the fundamental principle of political equality. People familiar with Buckley will remember one of the most famous passages in Buckley is when the Supreme Court says that it is wholly foreign to the First Amendment to allow the silencing of some voices in order to promote political equality, that there may be other things the government can do, but it cannot silence anybody from speaking under the First Amendment. In other words, Buckley rejects that equality rationale and says that any limits on speech of this sort have to go to a narrower rationale of preventing political corruption. So this is a rejection of Buckley's rejection of the equality rationale. Secondly, it runs exactly into the vagueness concerns that have shaped much of campaign finance law since Buckley. One of the core issues in the Federal Election Campaign Act that was at issue in Buckley was that the law allowed restrictions on any speech relevant to or relative to a campaign for office. The Supreme Court says this is far too vague and much more than could normally be tolerated under the First Amendment. What does it mean, speech relative to an office, or speech in another part of the statute where it says for the purpose of influencing election to an office? Almost all speech, and certainly all speech about politics in any way, has that potential. And so the court has always required some greater measure of specificity before it would approve any statute. Generally, it has focused on the idea of express advocacy or its equivalent. That is, before the government can regulate it, it has to be clear that you're talking about electing or defeating a candidate for office. This amendment, by doing away with that, by simply talking about anything that is in support of or opposition to a candidate, arguably is intended to allow for much greater leeway to regulate speech where it can be regulated. And third, those familiar with Buckley will know that Buckley famously said that you cannot limit expenditures. Buckley's notion here, a controversial notion, was that spending money doesn't really corrupt anybody. If you can raise $1 million by getting a million nuns to give you a dollar each, you're not corrupted when you spend that money. The potential for corruption occurs in the solicitation of the contribution and the giving of the contribution. So Buckley has always allowed for unlimited spending, and this amendment, of course, would specifically authorize limits on political spending. I also know an important part of this amendment is that it includes in-kind equivalents. So presumably Congress could regulate all kinds of personal activities that people might do that would be deemed as in-kind equivalents, volunteer time, and so on. It's very hard to say just how far that would go. These kinds of amendments come up fairly regularly, but this is one of the most serious efforts we've seen in recent years. Usually they come up after a Supreme Court case that upholds certain speech rights in connection with campaigns, and some have been reasonably serious in their efforts. But this, I think, is we might say a new level in the sense that it has been wholly endorsed by the Democratic Party leadership in both houses. In the U.S. Senate, where it originates, it has had a committee hearing already. It should be voted out of that committee on a straight party line vote, and Senator Reid has promised to bring it to the floor. 43 co-sponsors are there. All of them are Democrats. There are only, I think, a dozen or 13 Democrats who are not co-sponsors, and those include many who are expected to support the amendment, such as Senator Leahy and others. So this is a serious effort. I think in the end it's not going to pass. It has no chance of passing a Republican-controlled House. Probably can't get the necessary supermajority to get past the U.S. Senate. But it is something that I think should be taken seriously as emblematic of where Democratic Party, and I think we can put it in those party terms, although we can also simply frame it as folks who would favor more regulation of politics at this point, where they are looking to go and what they would want to do. I hope that's a good enough introduction to turn it over to Eugene to talk a little bit more about some of the specifics of the bill, and in particular, I think this interesting Section 3, which follows up on the vast grant of power to Congress to regulate in this area by saying, again, nothing in this article shall be construed to grant Congress the power to abridge the freedom of the press. So, Eugene, I'll let you take it from there.
Great. Thanks very much, Brad. I really appreciate it. I think I basically agree with the substance of your analysis. I just want to add a little bit about the free press issues. So if you look carefully at Section 3 of the proposal, it says nothing in this article should be construed to grant Congress the power to abridge the freedom of the press. Sections 1 and 2, however, provide for power on the part of Congress and the power on the part of states to restrict the amount of funds that may be spent by, in support of, or in opposition to candidates. So really, if you read this literally and assume they knew what they were talking about, that sounds like a pretty candid admission that states would be allowed to abridge the freedom of the press under this proposal. So really, if this had been the proposal that the final version, I think that would be a pretty powerful admission that this doesn't just go to what people think of as campaign finance, but goes to regulation of a wide range of publications, including newspapers, magazines, and the like. But let's assume that that's just a mistake, that somehow when they were proposing this resolution and reading through it, they meant to say Congress or the states, and so Congress just forgot to do that. And let's step back and see the bigger picture. Sections 1 and 2 make clear what the goal is, advancing the fundamental principle of political equality for all. Now, throughout American history, one group of people have had much more political influence than others, and those are publishers of newspapers, magazines, and the like. I say this simply descriptively. I'm not saying that they shouldn't have had this influence, but without doubt they have had this influence. Because especially back when newspapers, magazines, or especially newspapers were the main game in town, before the internet, before even broadcasting, there was no doubt that the newspaper publisher, a newspaper editor, would have tremendous influence over both local races, statewide races, and in some measure, federal races as well. And that's just so because this person had this vast audience built, often through the help of the corporate form. Most newspapers are owned by corporations, built using considerable amount of money. And of course, when newspapers or other publications speak, they necessarily speak using the spending of money. If you want to publish an editorial, you've got to pay somebody to write the editorial. There's probably going to be a meeting of the editorial board. Under any reasonable accounting system, the column inches devoted to the editorial would be counted for as a considerable expenditure. So really, if you take seriously the logic of this proposal, it makes a lot of sense that they would say, for example, that they wouldn't say anything about states abridging the freedom of the press. In fact, just as the logic of the proposal counsels in favor of restricting the speech of rich people or rich businesses generally, it would counsel in favor of restricting the speech of newspapers, magazines, and others as well. Now, this having been said, it does look from Section 3, like the proposers, at least as to Congress, want to step back a bit from their commitment to the supposedly fundamental principle of political equality for all. That they seem to be willing to allow the press, whatever exactly that is, to retain its First Amendment rights, even while those who are not the press would lose their First Amendment rights in some measure. Now, note, existing law does not distinguish the press in the sense of some, at least existing First Amendment law, does not distinguish the press in the sense of some favored group of people or employees of certain businesses and the like from others. The freedom of the press has long been understood as not meaning the freedom of the press as an industry or as a business. It has been understood as the freedom of all to use the press in the sense of the technology, the printing press in its modern technological eras. The freedom of the press has long been understood, and I wrote an article which shows that this understanding goes back to the framing era and pretty solidly until the present, and of course reaffirmed in Citizens United, as the freedom of all to use, including using their own money, to use mass communication technology. This proposal would change that. What it would say, without being very specific about how it's defined, is that somehow a group called the press, presumably owners of newspapers and magazines, perhaps employees of newspapers and magazines, retain their free speech rights, whereas others who aren't the press, who just want to be publishers for a day, who want to rent space in a newspaper rather than publish the newspaper day in and day out, they lack those rights. That the LA Times might have the rights, but a blogger, whether he is supported by a corporation or not, whether he spends a lot of money or a little money, is not. that possibly even that book authors, for example, wouldn't qualify depending on how the press is defined. So that's what the proposal would really require. Either you'd have to take seriously the notion that we value equality above all, including above freedom of speech and of the press, in which case Section 3 shouldn't be there, and Congress should have, and the states should have the power to restrict equality, diminishing speech by newspapers, magazines, and the like. Or you say, well, no, we want to protect the freedom of the press, in which case you have to say, well, but that freedom only belongs to favored few, to those who happen to be in the business of publishing on a full-time basis, a newspaper and a magazine. And if somebody wants to rent space on a broadcaster or in a newspaper or on a billboard or some such in order to put up political messages, just on an occasional basis, they would lack the constitutional rights that those who are full-time members of the media would possess. That would have to be the understanding of Section 3, unless either the Section 3 would essentially eliminate Sections 1 and 2 altogether, or would essentially be a nullity. I think that's a pretty dangerous thing. I actually sympathize with some of the concerns of self-described campaign finance reformers. I think that there are serious equality issues in a situation where people who have more fame or wealth or access to printing presses and the like have more influence on politics. I just think that that's an inequality that is an inherent part of freedom. I also think there are serious concerns both about bribery through the contribution and sometimes even independent expenditure process and what one might think of as extortion. If a candidate comes to a businessman, either directly or indirectly, and says, hey, you know, I regulate you, how about donating some amount of money to me, or how about spending some amount of money supposedly independently of me, the businessman might feel under substantial pressure to go along with that. So those, I think, are serious, serious concerns. I just don't think that they justify the restriction on speech and press would be involved in this proposal, and that they don't justify trying to minimize that exception by giving certain people in certain businesses special constitutional rights that others do not possess.
So with that, very good. Thank you both. I want to turn to the audience for questions, but first I want to hear from Professor Smith to see if you have want to augment your statement at all, Professor. And hold on a second. It looks like we've muted his phone. I apologize for that. Professor Smith, you're now unmuted if you'd like to augment your opening remarks.
No, I think Gene covered it well. And I think Gene has made an important point, which is I think almost anybody, even a person like myself who has made his reputation largely for arguing that campaign finance laws have been harmful and that people should have a right to participate in politics in this way, would recognize that there are serious equality issues and corruption issues that exist. And, of course, this is always the stated reason for such efforts. In fact, of course, in this case, it's specifically stated in the preamble. I would just add that there is, to emphasize a point I think Eugene made, is that I think the First Amendment approach has always been that it's simply a very dangerous power to give the government. Of course, the government is never going to say, well, we're limiting this person's speech or this class of people's speech because we don't like what they're saying about us, they threaten our grip on power, or they oppose our agenda. They're always going to say, well, these people have a lot of power, and they're always going to say, well, they have it in some way that others do not. And so these are the inherent problems of campaign finance. And for me, the big question, we'll see what listeners think, but the big question is, to what extent are we prepared to essentially, you know, take the constraints off of the legislature? Because when you have an amendment like this, one of two things can happen. Either the court will say, well, support or oppose a candidate has to be interpreted just as narrowly as we interpreted it in Buckley, you know, and they'll have largely gutted the amendment, or they're going to have to say, boy, this amendment's clearly intended to overrule Buckley, which I think is the case, and that means it's pretty much anything goes as far as what the legislature wants to do. Are we prepared to trust legislatures with that power? And that's the question.
Very good. Let's open the floor to questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question, indicate so by pushing the star button and the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. We are getting a few questions here. Let me ask the first question, which I think can be dispensed with pretty quickly. We are in the amendment here. I mean, the amendment requires nothing. It doesn't impose any regime. It just permits Congress to act to the extent it wants, and that would require a presidential signature on a piece of legislation, and that would implicate political accountability. Is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that's right, except it also applies to states. So
right.
Congress
right.
or the states could do that. The other interesting thing, of course, is the amendment doesn't actually mandate that whatever they do would have to be done in any particular way, including doesn't mandate viewpoint neutrality, doesn't mandate neutrality as between incumbents and others and the like. So in principle, given that Congress and the states have the power to impose limits on the amount of funds that might be spent by in support of or in opposition to such candidates, I suppose they could say, well, if you're engaging in what we choose to call negative advertising, you can only spend $100. Or if you are engaging in racist appeals, you can only spend $100. So the fact that it gives Congress and states power to do this, in a sense, makes it somewhat even more dangerous, because we can't tell for sure how that power will be exercised, and at least it's possible, but there's no limitation on this, it's possible that it could be exercised in ways that would be content and viewpoint discriminatory.
To add just a touch to that point that Eugene makes there, and I know, Eugene, in fact, you've written a lot on the Second Amendment and what to do with that. It's one amendment that has a preamble clause, a well-regulated militia clause. And I think the growing consensus has been, in part thanks to your research, that these types of preambles are not necessarily part of the substantive amendment. That is, the substantive amendment is Congress shall have the power to regulate and raise the raising and spending of money. So in theory, of course, the amendment could be interpreted in such a way, or certainly would not be judicially enforceable in another way, that Congress can, maybe it has this power to advance the fundamental principle of political equality for all and to protect the integrity of the legislative and electoral process. But having this power, it can use it for whatever reason it wants. There's not really a check that would be enforceable. The judiciary is not likely to come in and say, well, this doesn't advance political equality, and therefore you can't do it. You're just trying to get your political opponents. So I do think that fits with what you're saying, Eugene, that we can end up with lack of content neutrality, or many other First Amendment doctrines that have been well established might be gutted by this.
That's right. But what's more, even if a court does decide to look to the preambles, you know, well, those preambles are pretty capacious. So, for example, let's say the Congress says, we believe that appeals, including what we consider hidden appeals to racial and religious and sexual orientation prejudice, interfere with political equality. You know, plausible to say they do. So, therefore, we're going to sharply limit to the extent of essentially prohibiting any campaign-related speech that we think interferes with political equality by sending coded racist or religiously bigoted messages. That you wouldn't have to ignore the preamble in order to uphold that under the new proposal. In fact, it's perfectly consistent with the preamble as well as with the operative language.
All right, let's check in with our first caller.
Hello, Tony Conti from Massachusetts calling. I wonder, a couple of points. I wonder if the professors would opine as to whether we could score some points by attacking this proposal for what it is, namely fascism. This is basically authorizing the state to regulate speech, basically, and that's an element of fascism in my mind. You know, a word that's thrown around a lot, but usually not by our side. And I wonder, you know, if that wouldn't be appropriate. And number two, noting that the press is exempt from this, you know, the media, I think almost everybody would acknowledge, is overwhelmingly supportive of the liberal Democrat side of views. This is, you know, another effort to restrict those, you know, that oppose the Democrat liberal view. and so that it is really a partisan attack on one side of the from one side of the aisle on the other. And I wonder also whether this would the reference to the press would also include electronic media.
Well, I'll try that first, I guess. This is Brad. There certainly is, of course, on the political right, a sense that there is a strong effort now by the political left to use the tools of government to silence opposing views. I think that is clearly out there, and I won't comment more on the extent to which I think that is a reality or not. But it is an issue that it is out there. I'm not sure that attacking the amendment in that way gets one much beyond that conservative base. That is, if one does not like this amendment, I'm not sure that attacking it in that manner gets you very far, as opposed to simply attacking it as noting that this is an effort to amend the First Amendment. I think most Americans have a strong sense of fealty to the Constitution. They may not always understand it, but they are reluctant to see the Constitution be trifled with, to be meddled with, to be changed. And I think what is inescapable is when you look at this amendment is that it raises just dozens and dozens of questions about what power the government would have and what protections we would have for our free speech if this were to pass. Again, we talk about cabining it off. I mean, Congress could say we find that certain types of speech about global warming harm the integrity of the electoral process by misleading the public about the facts of climate change. So could you limit, speech that would go much broader than what we might even think of normally as political speech? And I think that simply raising, that kind of issue, pointing out that this is an effort to amend the Constitution for what seems to be short-term considerations, Eugene's point, which I had not noticed actually, about how Section 3 goes ahead and seems to give the states the power to regulate the press, shows the carelessness with which this was drafted. And I would just add one final point here. I do think that a lot of the supporters of this are supporting it because they don't believe it has any chance of passing. They think it's a good thing for a liberal base to say we're opposed to Citizens United, see how we're trying to do something. And I do think that they should be held to account for that we should take this seriously as an amendment of where people want to go. It will be harder if it begins to look like this could pass a House 4 years from now for a senator who supported this now to suddenly say, well, now that it's going to pass, I don't really think I'm going to support it. People get trapped by positions they state, even if they state them for political reasons. So I'll stop there, but I think this is a very dangerous amendment, and I think it can be attacked on its own grounds if one wants to do that on its own substance.
I agree entirely with Brad. Let me just add one thing. I'm always hesitant about people throwing around words such as fascism. Look, if all that Mussolini had done in Italy is imposed a restriction on the spending of money for politics, fascism wouldn't be a pejorative term. There are other countries, perfectly democratic countries, I shouldn't say perfectly, nobody's perfectly democratic, perhaps there shouldn't be, but countries we would consider democratic and free countries, I believe England is one of them, and I think there are others, in which campaign-related spending is sharply restricted. I don't like that. I think that's a mistake. I think that means they provide less liberty to their citizens than they would like. It doesn't make them fascist. America, until a few decades ago, American law allowed pretty broad restrictions on speech, including political speech. Look, consider the World War I era cases. I'm glad those cases were essentially overruled, but it doesn't mean we were fascist back then. So, no, I think that it's both not intellectually sound and ultimately politically counterproductive to try to overstate this as fascism. It's bad and should be opposed for that reason, but without overstatement.
Let's go to our next caller.
Thank you, gentlemen, for a really interesting presentation. This is Roger Kondoradia. I suppose if Senator Udall really wanted political equality, he would favor choosing senators by lottery or something. But my question is that I'm focusing on those words about an in-kind equivalent. Because it seems to me that I don't know whether you'd want to call it fascism or some kind of totalitarianism or not, but wouldn't it be an inclined equivalent to allow somebody to stand up and speak at a Grange potluck, or to call all the people in his address book, or to go door to door around his block to encourage his neighbors to vote for John Doe?
Eugene, you want to take this one?
No, Brad, I'll let you take the lead.
Okay, well, I'll just say yes. I mean, I think that's one of the types of problems with this amendment. An in-kind equivalent is a very, very broad term, and as you say, we could monetize almost anything. What's the value of standing up and speaking to a group at a club picnic or organizing rally? What's the value of sending something out to your email accounts or posting something on Facebook? Again, I think that's one of the ways in which this amendment should raise alarms of people, and it should make people say to those, in my view, who sponsor it, are you a serious person? If you're not, we shouldn't be, you know, considering you for office. Or if you are serious about this, I think we have some other problems that we really need to consider next time you're up for election.
Let me just add one thing. If you look carefully at the text, it doesn't just say Congress shall have and the state shall have the power to set limits on contributions and expenditures in support of or in opposition to candidates. Rather, what it says is that Congress shall and the states shall have power to regulate the raising and spending of money and in-kind equivalents with respect to state and federal elections, including through setting limits in contributions and spending. So really, it's any spending with respect to federal elections that would be regulable. That includes speech that is neither in support of nor in opposition to candidates, so long as it's with respect to federal elections. So if Congress doesn't like the way that elections are covered, even if the people covering them are not at all speaking out in support or opposition to candidates, but merely concludes that, you know, maybe they're being covered unfairly or being covered unwisely or whatever else, Congress and the states shall have the power to do that more broadly. So really, that's the operative language. Power to regulate the raising and spending of money and in-kind equivalents with respect to elections. That is the power that it would have, whether or not it uses express words of advocacy or whether or not it's even opinionated, that anybody who's maybe covering some scandal could be seen as speaking with respect to federal elections.
Isn't that totalitarian by definition?
No. No, it's not totalitarianism. I'll just give you an example. England, until recently, basically had no constitutionally enforceable limits on the power of Parliament. Parliament had the power to do everything that this article provides, and then some. It had the power to ban all speech advocating some political cause because England just didn't have judicial review. Was England a totalitarian country as a result? No, it wasn't. Did it have constitutional structures that maybe made totalitarianism somewhat more likely? Probably, although hard to say. Despite their lack of a First Amendment altogether, they seem to have been non-totalitarian pretty much for several centuries. So no, this isn't totalitarian. Yes, this would be bad. There's plenty that's bad about this amendment that can be criticized about the amendment without undermining the criticism, without losing our credibility by overstating the criticism.
All right, let's take another call.
John Rowland, Constitution.org. It seems that this proposal provides us with a wonderful teaching moment and an opportunity to use it against the sponsors in the next election, not just on the basis of that it's an amendment to the First Amendment or that it would be fascist, but simply as a monumental exercise of incompetence, which would then reflect on everything else that those sponsors support or oppose in Congress. And if it seems likely they lose ground in the next election, they themselves and their supporters may attribute it in part to their sponsorship of this amendment and lay to rest, at least for another generation, efforts of this kind. So what can we do to encourage candidates all across the spectrum, not just in the Republican Party, to hit them hard over this monumental idiocy?
Well, John, I think that goes with what I had suggested earlier, that I think this is something that should make voters ask. Are my representatives, my senators who are co-sponsoring this, are they serious? If they're not, that's kind of a strike against them, that they would propose amending the Constitution in a way that's not serious. And if they are serious, that raises a number of other very troubling questions, because this amendment has many troubling aspects to it. I do think that this was proposed, I believe, primarily as a means to rally base support on the political left, and I believe that it could boomerang were it to be used aggressively by a candidate opposing them, saying, you know, my opponent seeks to amend the First Amendment to reduce our speech rights. And so I think you're right. I think that is something that those who oppose this amendment could use. I will add one other point, which is Eugene has taken up but a couple points, the question of, you know, how would you use that, and what about talking about totalitarianism and fascism and so on. And I agree with Eugene entirely that we need to avoid that kind of overblown rhetoric. And no, this is not totalitarianism in and of itself. I would say that I think a legitimate criticism, but one that needs to be made very carefully and perhaps not as strong, is this creates a system in which totalitarianism could become more likely. And I think that was Gene's point to an extent about the powers of Parliament. They could have done these things. They never did. This amendment could be adopted, and maybe Congress would never pass any law, or maybe pass only the most trifling laws, you know, limiting what you can spend independently to $1 million in a contract-neutral way, that kind of thing, that would have hardly any impact anybody would feel. I always think the Constitution is there in part as an ultimate safeguard against really evil people. And I think that's why Americans don't like the idea of messing with the Constitution, why they're always reluctant to do so, especially with the Bill of Rights provisions. And for that basic reason, if we simply take the approach of saying, look, your senator is talking about amending the Bill of Rights to reduce your rights to free speech, that is a very simple and a very powerful argument.
I'm not a politico. I don't know what's going to play well with voters. My suspicion is that some of the legal points we're describing here are going to be things that are not at least obviously correct to voters, and we may not have the time to convey them. Also, my sense is that voters are mostly concerned about other issues, and it may be hard to get them concerned about this one. But who knows? I might be wrong. I will say that as to things that are worth mentioning, the fact that this will diminish Bill of Rights protections, I think, is important. I think in principle, Bill of Rights is amendable just like anything else, but I do think people are rightly concerned about it. I think the second point that might be articulated as, you know, Democratic legislators are perfectly happy to exempt their friends in the media from this, but if you're not a member of the press, whatever favored group it would set up here, you wouldn't have the protection. I think would be an important point. One other point, and I'm not sure how well it'll play politically, but I think is an important thing to keep in mind about this, is look at the power to draw districts. It sounds at first like this is just some weird kind of technocratic thing. Well, yeah, we're going to have districts drawn, so legislature's going to have to do that, but, you know, just do it in some fair-minded way. From almost the foundation of the Republic, that power was used in order to essentially as a means of incumbency protection. It's not just weird speculation that legislatures will use the power to protect the incumbency. It's not just kind of a matter of ordinary human nature that people try to use their power to protect themselves. It is a proven reality throughout two centuries of American life, whether it's through the patronage system or through the franking privilege or through gerrymandering. As a result, it would just be it would be shocking. It would be a really surprising departure from both history and human nature if this extra power wasn't used in, as a means of incumbency protection. And that, I think, might be an important point to make.
Let's take another call.
Hello, this is Jim Lucas with TimelyRenewed.com. I agree with the professors as far as their concerns or freedom concerns with this amendment. I think it's very offensive. Yet when I flip myself around and I look at this document as a lawyer, I have to ask if it doesn't contain a self-destructive loophole in that Section 3. At some point, the Supreme Court will have to decide what the press is, as that term is used in the third section of this amendment, if it were to pass. And any minimally competent lawyer after that would have to assist any group in turning itself into whatever the press is. I mean, any advocacy group, political party, whatever, could, especially one that had lots of resources, I should think it, fairly easily then conform itself to whatever the Supreme Court had said the press was, and therefore by exempt itself from whatever laws had been passed under the authority of this amendment. So I'm just wondering if what your views would be on the thought that that exception, which is obviously there for political reasons to make the thing more palatable, is not in practice a potential loophole which would eat the entire amendment.
Well, a lawyer certainly could and should make those arguments. The question is whether judges will buy those arguments. Some judges, of course, are quite sympathetic to limiting the ability of groups to spend money in order to advocate with regard to elections. We saw that in Citizens United, 4 out of the 9 justices were willing to do that. So those justices, I think, would say, well, no. The press is just it's a limited exception for those things that look traditionally like newspapers and magazines, let's say, and you just don't count. Totality of the circumstances test. On top of that, there may be justices who actually would agree with the majority with Citizens United, but say, look, it's our duty to try to interpret the constitutional amendment as a law. One standard canon of construction is we do not interpret laws as essentially nullities. We try to harmonize the provisions in them. So if the consequence of reading the press broadly is that essentially anybody can claim to be the press and therefore use Section 3 to escape the limits of Sections 1 and 2, why then in that case we're not going to do that, because that would be a kind of violation of our obligation as judges to read the entirety of the statute in a way that's coherent. The amendment that's the way that's coherent. So I think if it gets enacted, you could make whatever arguments you can, and you should make those arguments, and maybe they might prevail in some measure. I quite doubt that that's going to be much of a salvation. Finally, note that Section 3, as I mentioned, explicitly applies only to federal government, not to states. So whatever arguments you make there, states would still be free to do whatever they want. And in fact, the very fact that they're not mentioned in Section 3 seems to strongly imply that they're free to limit what used to be the freedom of the press. Finally, let me just mention one thing. I said earlier, and I have a law review article, which is, I think, about 80 pages that supports this, that under the First Amendment, the freedom of the press has long been understood as the freedom of everybody to use printing press technology. But there are lots of statutes out there that actually do provide special protection to certain kinds of speakers that are defined as press or media speakers. So there is a history throughout American law of statutes indeed treating the certain speakers differently based on whether they are full-time or based on whether they do it for pay or something along those lines. And those, too, can be turned to by judges and say, look, we're told to try to distinguish the press from others here. Well, we're going to do the best we can.
We've got 2 caller questions pending. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. A quick announcement. Tomorrow afternoon, we will very likely have a teleforum on the Argentina bond cases, which were decided earlier this week by the U.S. Supreme Court. That's sort of in the final stages of being scheduled, so check your emails and the Federal Society website on that. And then on Thursday at 12 noon Eastern Time, we'll be visiting with John Fund and Hans von Spakovsky, talking about their new book on the role of the Department of Justice. For now, again, if you have a question, you'd like to join the callers asking questions today, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let's go to our next caller.
Hi, Professor. It's Michael Aker. I'm a legal research attorney here in up just north of Professor Volokh. Ever since law school, when I read Schenck versus the United States, I've followed kind of the commentary on First Amendment freedom of speech issues. And one of the things that bothers me, and what my question is, I would like for both the professor just to kind of opine on this. When I follow, there seems to be two camps with First Amendment interpretation. One is kind of the Chemerinsky tribe camp that goes, there's no absolute right in the Bill of Rights, and therefore we can do things like say you can't yell fire in a crowded theater and not, you know, expect to get some kind of criminal penalty. And then there's another camp that seems to think that maybe it's not an absolute right, but it's as damn near close as that absolute right could be. And I guess my question is, it seems like the first camp is winning just on almost all Bill of Rights issues. And why do you think that is? Do you agree with that? And then why do you think that is?
So let me suggest a somewhat different view of the matter. I think that there's basically nobody on the court, either now or in the past, who has ever taken an absolute or even close to absolute view of the freedom of speech, or for that matter, most of the other constitutional rights, so that's a little complicated as to the others. Even Justice Black, who claimed to be a First Amendment absolutist, would get out of it by cheating. You look at Cohen v. California, the case involving vulgarities, what happened there was that Black was a dissenter, and he said, no, wearing this jacket with vulgarity on it, that's constitutionally unprotected. Why? Because it's mainly conduct and little speech. What's the conduct? Well, sure, wearing a jacket is conduct, but so is moving your lips, so is carrying a sign. Really, he just didn't like the speech. Most justices are just more candid than that. They say, look, freedom of speech can't be understood both as a practical matter and as a historical matter, is protecting all speech. It has long been understood that certain kinds of speech is unprotected. Libel is a classic example. Some people think there should be no libel law, but that's never been the view in American history. No justice has taken such a view. Likewise, threats. If I say I'm going to kill you, or even your money or your life, I haven't yet taken your money, nor have I displayed a weapon, well, that's speech. Nobody thinks that, at least nobody on the court thinks or has ever thought that that should be constitutionally protected. So to the extent that one either cares about American traditions or cares about inferences about what the framers intended or framers understood by the meaning of those provisions, then you can't be an absolutist or even a near absolutist. One reason that is so is simply because the provisions are so short and life is so complicated. If you say freedom of speech or of the press, then in that case, you know, that's just not enough to cover all of the various kinds of restrictions. I haven't even gotten to content-neutral restrictions. What about my right to speak at a very, very loud volume out in the middle of a residential neighborhood at night? So I don't think there really is any room for genuine First Amendment absolutism out there. The right question to ask, I think it is important to take a broad view of freedom of speech, and some justices have taken broader and some narrower, and some broader in some areas and some in other areas. I think the right question to ask is, for each restriction, what are the arguments, historical, functional, textual, and the like, for and against it? I will say that one advantage of a constitutional amendment model is that you can specify somewhat more precisely, well, certain kind of speech is constitutionally unprotected. I think that's one good thing about the proposal, is at least it doesn't try to read these restrictions into the freedom of speech. It just specifically tries to delineate them. It just doesn't do a very good job of delineating them. But I think talk of absolutism is not terribly helpful here. I think absolutism is not an appealing position. It's not a position that's consistent, as best I can tell, with the views of the framers. It's not consistent with American traditions to the extent that matters. And I think the court has been right not to follow it. Well, it has also been right to read the free speech protections as suitably broad.
Professor Smith, you want to weigh in here?
To add just a bit on that, Michael, one of the things I think is interesting is, again, how strong should the presumption be? In campaign finance cases and in his book Act of Liberty, Justice Breyer has argued that there is no room for a presumption against constitutionality on campaign finance statutes. And he says, well, you know, there's First Amendment interest on both sides. That is, the interest in fostering a good governmental or good debate about government, and therefore there may be interest in restricting some speech. We'll make sure that maybe more people are heard. We'll make sure the debate is better, that it's less negative. If you think that's good, I mean, you can go a lot of directions with that. Well, I would agree with Eugene that yes, I don't think you can really interpret anything absolutely, although I always like to point out that contrary to the old maxim, first you can shout fire in a crowded theater, and if the theater's on fire, it's actually encouraged that you do that. I also always laugh that that's pointed out to that. That comes from Schenck, which is not one of the Supreme Court's prouder moments, when the Supreme Court was upholding Woodrow Wilson laws aimed at suppressing political dissent. But it strikes me that Breyer is totally wrong in suggesting there's no room for presumption against constitutionality, that when you have a phrase that says Congress shall make no law restricting freedom of speech, and you agree that this does in some way restrict freedom of speech, and Breyer does agree with that point, it seems to me that there has to be at least a presumption that the law that the government passes is unconstitutional. And then the question is, how much does the government need to show, to demonstrate, to overcome that presumption, to fit it into a historical category such as libel, or to come up with some other, you know, pressing reason why we should allow this speech to be limited? And I think one of the reasons that this has been, in some ways, may seem to be under attack, and at least in the area of campaign finance, is the way these cases tend to go. If somebody makes a free speech claim, this violates my free speech rights, the government then comes in and says, well, we have to prevent corruption, and the Supreme Court has recognized that that's a valid thing to do. So we need a big record about how corrupt this is, and they insist on providing this huge record, and you get, you know, all this self-interested testimony from congressmen who favor the legislation, saying, "Oh yes, I feel very corrupted, and if we pass this legislation, I won't feel corrupted anymore." And all, you know, self-serving newspaper editorials and innuendos, and every little case of actual corruption which occurs, which there is actual corruption, and all of this is put together, and there's just sort of a vague assumption, well, of course the speech has some value, but now let's focus on this huge 300-page record of corruption. This is the record, you know? And so it kind of drives these cases into a standpoint in which it's very easy for judges to forget that there are simply values to free speech, that this is not just a question of, you know, how far government should be able to go in regulating, and of course they can regulate some, and how bad is the problem. It shifts any attention away from the flip side, which is, what are the problems of regulation? What is the First Amendment intended to prevent? What are the benefits of free speech? You know, free speech is not something that, well, we just have to tolerate it because for some crazy reason a bunch of old white guys stuck it in the Constitution, but rather that it does bring positive benefits to us. So I would agree with Eugene on the question of absoluteness, but I do think you raise an important point in suggesting that, you know, we need to get judges and lawyers and the public generally thinking more commonly that the presumption, the norm, is that Congress doesn't regulate in this area, and certainly not in the core part of the First Amendment, which has been consistently recognized to be political speech.
Well, now let's turn to what appears to be our final question.
Yeah, this is Andy Carter. I'm in Washington, D.C. I was just wondering, in listening to your comments, it sounds like both Professor Smith and Professor Volokh seem to think that, well, your major attacks on this legislation are centered on the drafting of it. It seems like it's been inartfully drafted by people not very familiar with First Amendment jurisprudence. So I guess my question is, can it be salvaged for those who really do believe that there's certain speech that is really important and needs to be regulated? Can it be salvaged, or is just the principle inherently inconsistent with a freedom-loving nation?
Well, by pointing out the glitch in Section 3, which says this won't be construed to allow the federal government to restrict liberty of the press, but doesn't mention the state government. But then I said, look, that is just, it could be discussed as just a drafting error. I think drafting errors are important things to point out, because I do think they show something about the lack of quality of the thinking behind the proposal. But I went on to what I think is the more substantive issue, which is, how seriously do you take the notion that equality of access to political life trumps free speech rights? You could take it very seriously indeed. For example, you might think that, in fact, it would be wrong for newspapers to have the power to influence elections, both because that's unequal and because it's potentially corrupting. If somebody owns a newspaper and incidentally may own other businesses, calls up his local congressman or the mayor who's running for re-election and says, you know, we're deciding whom to endorse for the coming election. What's your view on this particular proposal, which, as it happens, will influence the publisher's business interests? Well, the mayor is going to take that call, and the mayor is going to feel pretty strong pressure to accommodate the publisher's demands. So you might, in fact, say, if you really are committed to political equality, newspapers should be restricted too. For that matter, what about celebrities? I don't think there's anything particularly fair that Jennifer Lopez, if she speaks out in favor of a candidate, will draw lots and lots of attention, whereas Jennifer Smith, who just lives her normal life and is not famous, wouldn't draw that kind of attention. That's a departure from political equality. Should we therefore bar these kinds of celebrity endorsements? I think if one really thinks that political equality is so important that it doesn't matter contravailing free speech and free press rights don't matter, well, then in that case, one could draft a proposal. It would be a proposal I would disapprove of, but one certainly could draft a proposal that embodies that. But on the other hand, if what you say is, you know, this is the most important thing, but we're going to have a special savings clause for newspapers, and as it happens, most newspapers today are really on our side, but no, just an accident, nothing to see here. Well, I think that makes for a much less credible suggestion, and I think we'll rightly be faulted for increasing political inequality in some respects in an attempt to decrease political equality. So it all depends on what your bottom line political moral commitments are. If you really think that it's equality above all, then in that case, sure, just get rid of Section 3, broaden Sections 1 and 2, and then you're going to have maximum protection for equality, even while acknowledging that that would impose very substantial restrictions on speech. My point is simply that one can't deny that these really are very substantial restrictions on speech.
Yeah, I would agree, and what I would notice, well, I don't like the way Eugene phrased that at the very end, saying, well, this would promote equality if we did away with Section 3 and broaden 1 and 2, because one of the things I do think is dangerous, of course, is equality is such a slippery concept, and essentially what it really does is give the government the power to do pretty much whatever it wants and simply call it equality. It comes in so many, you know, different forms. And so for that reason, I think the answer to your question is, I mean, I think there are drafting things in the amendment that could be done better, from the obvious error of not mentioning the states in Section 3 to more specific, you know, efforts to narrow down some of the provisions. But in the end, I don't think that this is something that you can do without raising these questions. So when I say, you know, look at all the questions this raises, look at all the uncertainties it raises, I don't really think you can pin a lot of that down. Ultimately, what this really is, it's a challenge to the core philosophy that I think guides the First Amendment. It's true that the First Amendment may not be absolute, but what we're putting out here is, you know, do you trust the government to broadly regulate political speech, or do you believe there should be broad constraints on the government's ability to regulate political speech? And I just don't really see, you know, much way that you could narrow this language and solve that problem. It's just going to be a question of whether you want to give this power to the government. And I think it's quite clear that when they drafted the Constitution, they did not want to give this power to the government. I think it's quite clear that it has served us well. Something that Eugene hinted at, and is quite true. I mean, most good free democracies do not have a First Amendment that is as strong as ours, that protects as much speech as ours. But I think ours has served our country well, that it fits our culture, that it fits our politics. And so in the end, I would come down the side that it's very hard for me to imagine any kind of amendment like this whose effort is a broad attempt to overturn 40-some years of First Amendment jurisprudence just on campaign finance that could be done. Maybe if they really had a narrower objective, if they just wanted to make clear that expenditures by corporations could be limited, you might be able to come up with a much more narrow type of drafting. But I don't think this was intended to do that. I think this really is intended to give very broad power here, and by definition then it will raise a lot of questions that cannot be resolved by drafting, and we'd only have to see what happened down the road for better or worse.
Well, we are going to have to leave it right there. Let me give my thanks and the Federalist Society's thanks to Professors Smith and Volek. We certainly appreciate your time and your insights today. To the audience, thank you for dialing in. Thank you for your participation. And a reminder to check our website and your emails for as we continue to finalize tomorrow's teleforum on the Argentina bond case. But until that next teleforum, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.